Well, hello and welcome everybody to ICMDA webinars. I'm Dr. Peter Saunders. Today we've got Larry Worthen, who's the director, speaking on conscientious objection and the duty of care. Now, the swift advance of euthanasia and assisted suicide in Canada and its corresponding effect on conscious rights should be a cautionary tale for the rest of the world. Nova Scotia doctors are currently fighting to practice medicine against regulators who are trying to normalize the practice of euthanasia by requiring an effective referral of patients to the service, so-called. And as the number of disturbing cases expands, more and more doctors are unable to comply with regulators who are threatening discipline for non-compliance. Now, I can think of no one more suited to speak to this than Larry Worthen, who is the Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association in Canada, one of our affiliated national bodies. Larry resides in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, with his wife and Dr. Linda Gagnon, who is a family physician. Larry is a lawyer himself. They've got two children and five grandsons. Larry, so good to have you on the program today. We're really looking forward to what you have to say and joining you with discussion afterwards. Over to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Peter, for this welcome and for this offer to speak today. It's very much appreciated. And I just wanted to mention that we need your prayers more than anything else. Right now, we're in the middle of a pitched battle here in the province of Nova Scotia in terms of mandated effective referral by our provincial college, the regulatory body. And we really need your prayers because we're up against a challenge that I think will soon be coming to other places in the world. So I think that our situation, our reality here in Nova Scotia is something that would be something that others should really pay attention to and be concerned about. I want to begin by just describing two patient scenarios that have occurred in Canada really in the last month. And this will give you an idea of what we're up against here in Canada. We've had legalized euthanasia in Canada since 2016. And during that time, we've had a dramatic increase in the numbers. We have, we estimate roughly 60,000 Canadians have died in the last 8 years. And we're now killing people at a rate that is second only to the Netherlands. And we anticipate that perhaps we have already surpassed the Netherlands in terms of the percentage of people who have died by euthanasia. The reason it's so high is because we have extremely vague criteria. We have a lack of any meaningful oversight. And it is delivered as a service provided through Canadian healthcare. And it is literally provided universally across the country in every secular-based hospital, hospice, nursing home. So it has become pervasive within Canadian healthcare. The two cases I want to talk to you about, I feel are tragic. One was the case of a 27-year-old woman who was on the autism spectrum and also had ADHD. She was in every other respect healthy, and she approached a physician and was able to be assessed for euthanasia and was approved to die by euthanasia because of her autism and her ADHD. She is living with her father, and when her father found out about this, he sought legal help and challenged this decision to approve her in court in Alberta. Sadly, he was unsuccessful in his attempt, and the matter is currently under appeal. But the problem with the case is that it is unlikely that he will be able to stop the daughter's euthanasia. The judge held that this particular young woman's dignity and right to self-determination outweigh the important matters raised by her father and the harm that he will suffer in losing her. one of his challenges, one of the challenges that he had was that he was concerned about her capacity to consent. And the problem we have in Canada is there is no appeal and no capacity of the judges to question or second guess the physician's opinion. People can shop for appropriate opinions from various doctors about whether the criteria in fact are there or whether or not the person is competent. And sometimes the physicians who are making these determinations are driven by ideology and their position that autonomy should trump all other ethical considerations at times like this. You can see that there is ableism inherent in the judge's decision. By ableism, I mean a sense that people with disabilities are not as valuable to society as able-bodied people when he says that her dignity is being challenged. And so the question would be, are people with disabilities or autism somehow, do they have less dignity than a person who is able-bodied? The second case was Normand Meunier, who was a tetraplegic. He's had that disability since 2022. This only happened recently at the end of March of this year. He went into the emergency room in Montreal with a lung infection and spent 4 days immobile on an ER stretcher in this Montreal emergency room. The reason that he was on a stretcher was they didn't have a room for him in the hospital, and they were unable to bring the special mattress down to put on the stretcher so that he would not get bed sores. Sadly, he experienced bed sores on his buttocks because of the type of mattress he had. And because of the bed sores, he applied for MAID and died on March 29th. Now, these are two examples that will show you how extreme things have gone in Canada in terms of medically assisted death. It's somewhat ironic because the government had recently decided to put off MAID for mental health until 2027, until after our election. In this case, the doctor said that the autism was a neurological disorder as opposed to a mental illness. So MAID was allowed. Now, if either of these cases occurred in Nova Scotia, then under a new policy being considered by our regulators, then the physician would be required to make what's called an effective referral for euthanasia. And also in the policy, the physicians might even be required to inform the patient about their accessibility for MAID even before they make a request for MAID. And in addition to this, they might even be asked to perform MAID in what are called emergent circumstances under the policy. We don't know what emergent circumstances mean, but we'll give you an example of the type of ambiguity that we're dealing with. Now, this policy also deals with issues like gender transition and abortion. Now, what is referral? And I just want to step back from these two cases and give you some background. The verb to refer in a medical context means to send or direct for treatment, aid, information, or decision. In a referral, the most responsible physician recommends that a consult, procedure, or service is necessary. And many Nova Scotia physicians, and indeed physicians throughout the world, consider making a referral to be a form of participation in a procedure. They're unable to provide a referral because of their ethical and moral convictions, especially when they believe that objectively the procedure will cause harm to the patient. And in this case, with MAID and abortion, someone actually dies. Now, in Nova Scotia, so far, 30 doctors have come forward and have written letters to our lawyer saying that they are unable to fulfill the requirements of the policy. And if they are disciplined or if they by the college, they will be unable to practice. And the college has already publicly said that they will discipline and remove the licenses of any doctors that don't comply with this. So we're in the middle of a huge conscience campaign. We have roughly until May 24th before the college is likely to consider the policy and vote on it. But we have hired government relations experts. We are mobilizing churches to write letters to politicians. We're lobbying the provincial government, and we've done several media opportunities so far. This is very much a David and Goliath type situation. And we ask our brothers and sisters all over the world to pray for the success of this campaign in Nova Scotia. Because if we fail here, then it's likely that this problem will spread to other provinces in Canada. And if they are able to completely remove Christian doctors from practice in Canada, then it's likely that that would spread to other countries as well. This gives you an idea of the crisis that we face in our province right now. Now, allow me to step back and provide some context for our viewers in other countries. In Canada, healthcare is regulated by the provincial governments. We have 10 provinces in our country. Our national government is responsible for the criminal law, and they legalized euthanasia and abortion by making a change in the criminal law. Now, this change was made because of a court decision, not out of the initiative of the politicians themselves. There was a decision of one judge in British Columbia, which is our westernmost province, and that judge basically set the criteria for euthanasia for Canada. Once that decision of that judge was approved by the Supreme Court of Canada, now those criteria are there etched in constitutional law. And anytime our politicians try to restrict those criteria for the safety of the patient, they are rebuffed by judicial appeal. So the result is that the courts are really driving the whole move for euthanasia. And in setting the criteria, they're actually imposing the judicial view on medical ethics and the conduct of medicine in Canada. This so far has been not opposed by our medical regulators. In fact, the medical regulators have been at the forefront of implementing this change in Canada and have actually developed policies for how MAID should be administered in all 10 provinces. Now, 8 out of 10 regulators have found language that balances patient rights and physician rights. But unfortunately, the Nova Scotia College is insisting on an effective referral, and so far is unwilling even to reconsider this position. Now, one thing I want to make absolutely clear is that our concerns are with procedures, not with patients. So we are quite open to providing services for all patients, regardless of any protected characteristic. We believe that we need to care for and love everyone just as Christ loves everyone. Our concern is that when we participate in certain procedures by making an effective referral or by providing information even before the patient makes a request, we are essentially participating in the administration of the patient's death. And we cannot do that because of our morals and our ethics. It's important, I think, to reiterate the Christian perspective, because what we are finding even in Canada, is that this Christian perspective for what an ethical or moral death means is starting to be eroded even in our churches because of the change in law. First of all, we have to remind ourselves that God has told us, "Thou shalt not kill." This is not something a church leader developed. This comes directly from the boss. This is directly from God. We shall not kill. And Jesus incorporated the Ten Commandments into his body of teaching when he was questioned by the rich young man, "What must I do to gain eternal life?" And we read about that in the 19th chapter of Matthew, verses 16 to 18. Now, We're an ecumenical organization, and I must say that we've had excellent support from various Christian groups. For our Catholic members, referral is essentially formal cooperation with evil, and morally is the same thing as actually providing the euthanasia itself. For evangelicals, we have an opinion, a theological opinion from the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. Dr. David Goretzky is the president of that and their resident theologian. And David has come out and said that for evangelicals, the practice of referral is wrong and goes against the strict interpretation of the Ten Commandments. It's not just Christians either. Orthodox Jews also have a problem with referral. And Muslims, in fact, have a problem with referral based on the prohibition against killing. And of course, many of our secular colleagues, even secular humanists, have a problem with euthanasia and referring for euthanasia because they feel that it undermines the dignity of the human person. And we read in 1 John chapter 2, verses 3 to 5, we know that we have come to know him if we keep his commands. Whoever says, I know him, but does not do what he commands is a liar, and the truth is not in that person. But if anyone obeys his word, love for God is truly made complete in them. And this is how we know that we are in him. So there's a strong prohibition, of course, against murder, against causing the death of a patient. And our faith must stay strong, and we must not waver in this conviction. Now, the winds are blowing very strongly against us as we sail our little boat across the harbor. First of all, there is the force of the law. And this is very much being imposed on the legal system from without. And you as physicians should be very concerned about the legal system driving medical ethics. This policy intervenes within the therapeutic relationship between a physician and a patient, and it does not trust the physician to act in the best interests of the patient. So it says that you must tell the patient about MAID. You must refer for MAID. What does that do to the relationship between a psychiatrist and their patient when the patient asks to die? What are the ethical and moral obligations on that psychiatrist? And is it true that every time a patient asks to die or indicates they're having suicidal thoughts, that the psychiatrist's responsibility is to refer the patient for euthanasia? Is that where we've come to? But these are the implications of the policy. And it all comes from the legal system monkeying around, being involved, messing around in the actual physician-patient relationship. That should be sacrosanct. And as physicians, you should resist that with all of your strength. The second are political and ideological pressures on healthcare. There are pressure groups, the abortion lobby, the MAID lobby. These people have disproportionate power with today's politicians because of their ability to use social media to marshal support. On the other side of this equation, Christians and others who want to support the value of human life, we are not as sophisticated in our capacity to influence public opinion using social media. We have to grow in our ability to do that. And many of our campaign tactics here are trying to be a counterbalance to the prevailing winds on social media. I think the other thing that's driving this is a consumer mentality. It's made worse by a single payer system. Socialized medicine is great in that it allows the poor to access medical care. But the problem is that the public tends to think that they own medicine, and they tend to want to usurp that autonomy of the medical practitioner and have it driven by public opinion or issues related to these things. And the single payer system tends to create an environment in which people feel we own healthcare, we own doctors, We are the consumers. We know what is right for ourselves. We simply want the doctor to provide the service and not to question what our goals are. And of course, this completely goes against medical ethics, because yes, autonomy is one component of medical ethics, but there are three other important components as well. You always have to act in the best interest of the patients, and you must first do no harm. The other problem we have is that often practitioners are afraid that if they say no to some of these things, that they will become targets on social media, will eventually end up being canceled. And I know this personally because my wife, we have a program here called Rate MD, and several negative statements were made about my wife on this platform because of a conscience issue that she dealt with. I would say that conscience itself in our society is not well understood. Conscience, in essence, I think, is almost a Christian term, where we have allowed for people when we had a predominantly Christian society, we've allowed for dissenters to be able to live according to their conscience. In a more secular environment, I find that secularists generally are not aware of their own subjectivity and tend to see their views as the objective truth. And as a result, conscience then becomes us listening to fairies, because they don't believe in God. They believe that conscience is just our personal opinion, as opposed to something that is rooted in a divine truth that is written on the heart of every individual person. So we're dealing with this tremendously progressive philosophy, where they believe that morality itself is culturally determined, that we're simply making up our ideas of morality, that they're not based on any objective or ultimate reality of being based in God, and God as the creator, understanding the very basis of the human person. And in this environment, autonomy is everything. The other thing that's affecting us, I think, is a very broad medicalization of life. I think it stems from trends like the World Health Organization definition of health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Some have criticized the World Health Organization definition by saying it doesn't provide a distinction between health and happiness. And so we get into what's called the medicalization of life, or in Canada, the medicalization of suffering, that there must be a medical response to every form of suffering, even existential suffering. A society without Christ creates a society with existential suffering. And we argue that MAID is not the answer to existential suffering. A good counterpoint for this is the writing of Dr. Farr Curlin. He wrote a book called Ethics and the Healing Profession with Christopher Tollefson. And I would really recommend that book because, and I've heard Farr talk, I think, three times now. And Farr's point is that we need to return medicine to the art of healing. And that if we focus on healing, that can be our purpose. So that as doctors, it's not that you're value neutral. Your value should be healing and the protection of human life. And I would just recommend that because Farr speaks strongly against this service delivery model. And I think this is really important today. If you're just functionaries that are providing a set range of medical services, then Farr would argue, and I agree, that it's no longer a profession. There's no longer the importance of the therapeutic relationship and doing what is in the best interest of your patient, regardless of all of these external pressures that I've mentioned. I think in the end, the large issue that is really at stake here in Nova Scotia, but I think because it's at stake in Nova Scotia, it's at stake throughout the whole world, is what is the soul of medicine? What is care? I think that's really the question. You know, our opponents accuse us of abandonment of the patient because we will not refer them to die or to kill the child within their womb. And I really think that the basic question here is what is care and what is ethical care? You see, in In Canada, we never actually dealt with the question of whether euthanasia was ethical. In the very first case, the judge held that there was no ethical consensus about MAID in Canada. But just because there's no ethical consensus doesn't mean that a regulator can come along and insist that you participate in it. And that's the problem. We haven't really had that discussion of whether or not MAID is ethical. And how can you demand that doctors participate in it if, in fact, you've never asked the question or had the debate about whether it's ethical? And the other question I think that needs to be raised is, if death is a therapeutic intervention, and our opponents say it is a therapeutic intervention, if death is a therapeutic intervention, then what is the incentive to do anything else? We saw this case in Montreal where this poor man got bed sores from complete negligence. And then he chooses MAID because he says, I don't want to be a burden. Well, that man has just internalized ableism and is taking responsibility for the gross failure of healthcare in Montreal. Now, is this right? Is this normal medical practice? And if this man dies from MAID, then what is the incentive for us to ensure that those mattresses are available when someone is in emergency in Montreal? If he's better off dead, and if that is a positive result of healthcare, then what is the motivation for doing anything else? And if, what is the point of suicide prevention, for instance? If that woman who has autism ends up just dying by MAID, what is the incentive to improve our mental health systems? What's the incentive to improve support for people on the autism spectrum if people can just get MAID? And then the very basic question is, what are we doing here in the first place? And I think that's the fundamental question you need to answer as medical practitioners. You need to, what is the big picture? What are you doing here in the first place? What is the purpose of your job? And you need to get that straightened out. You see, because if we don't straighten it out, and if the opposition is successful, then you will eventually be totally discouraged and disillusioned, because they will have succeeded in normalizing suicide and forcing us to be complicit and drastically changing society's perceptions of suicide and death. You know, when it, for us as Christians, it boils down to this. In ancient Rome, Christians were required to worship idols or the emperor. And they were asked to really accept pluralism. You know, there are many gods. You have your gods, we have our gods. You just worship our gods, and you can continue to worship your gods privately. But to do so would break the Ten Commandments. And we, in vast numbers, Christians in the early years of the church, said no. And because of that, we face martyrdom. But Tertullian said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And we don't need to be martyred if we will just fight against the culture of death. But sadly, I've seen here in Canada that fighting is the last thing that we like to do. But our witness in Canada should tell you specifically what happens if you don't fight. And I hope it gives you the impetus to look in your own situation, in your own country, and take action to ensure that medicine does not get diverted by the culture of death. God bless you, and I beg you again to pray for us in Nova Scotia.
Thank you so much, Larry. If you've just joined us, we've been listening to Larry Worthen, who is the director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association in Canada, ICMDA's member body there, who are fighting this huge battle in Nova Scotia. And we've got a time of question and answer now, so please do put your questions in through the Q&A icon at the bottom of the screen, and we'll pick those up in our discussion over the next 20 minutes or so. Just a reminder that today's session is being recorded and will be available from tomorrow from our website, and also along with the links to the book and the references that Larry has mentioned as well. Larry, 60,000 deaths chilling. And those two cases of the woman with autism and the man with tetraplegia just show us where it's going. And as you've been describing as well, the threat in Nova Scotia is a change in the law, which you're trying to oppose, which would bring in effective referral, where doctors would be required to refer their patients for euthanasia on request. Also, along with that, the duty to inform everybody of their right to euthanasia, even when they haven't asked for it. You can imagine a vulnerable patient feeling that from her doctor or his doctor. And then the issue of emergent circumstances. If someone's not available, then you're required not just to refer, but actually to do the deed yourself. And I'm sure people listening will just be overwhelmed and horrified by the thought that this is happening in a so-called democratic country, and that doctors are facing the loss of their license and quite possibly something more as well, as if there was this were to go through. Now, you started off by explaining to us how the law in Canada is probably the most liberal in the world now. You're about to pass the Netherlands, if you haven't already, in terms of the percentage of citizens who've lost their lives. Can you just explain to us what the criteria are at the moment? They seem incredibly broad from the cases that you're describing. What are the criteria in, mm-hmm. under Canadian law?
Well, part of the curse here for me, Peter, is that being a lawyer, I could see this from the very first decision.
Yeah.
It makes no sense to have one judge develop the criteria. That makes no sense. The criteria she developed were: it must be a grievous and irremediable illness. Grievous and irremediable are not legal or medical terms, and irremediable by any means acceptable to the patient.
Yeah.
So when we looked at MAID for mental illness, the committee that was looking at it came back and said, well, we don't really need any further criteria. It's just advice to the doctor. And that could irremediable could mean that the patient has just perhaps tried one treatment and they don't want to try anything else.
So it's incredibly subjectively defined, isn't it? It's not something that can be tested objectively.
That's right. That's right. And the problem is that it's all in the mind of the doctor. And there's no appeal. And we have some doctors in Canada who have done over 400 of these. So the problem is that if the doctor themselves believes in that autonomy trumps all other ethical considerations, then they will see this according to their own subjective interpretation. And one of our smaller provinces in eastern Canada, Newfoundland, which is close to the UK, no doctor in Newfoundland would provide MAID for a particular patient. And that patient contacted Dying with Dignity in Toronto, and they flew a doctor from Toronto to St. John's to euthanize the patient. So what happens is that they just simply doctor shop until they find somebody who perceives the person to have followed those criteria.
Yeah. So it's effectively euthanasia or assisted suicide on demand. There are no effective criteria, really. Have there been any successful prosecutions against doctors pushing the boundaries even wider than those set by the court?
Absolutely not. And you know, Peter, one of my staff pointed out to me yesterday that in the report in Quebec, there were 14 cases in the last year that did not comply with the grievous and irremediable criteria.
Yeah. So really, the erosion of conscience rights is really just the next logical step after everything that's happened already. Could just explain to us, you've got, and can never quite remember how many provinces and territories there are in Canada, but does each each one sets its own law on conscience. Is that right? They're
That's
not
correct.
set nationally.
That's correct. Yeah. One of the problems with Canada is that the federal government, the national government, controls criminal law. And so they legalize these things. But then the regulation of human rights and of healthcare is a provincial responsibility. So we have 10 provinces and three territories. So each one of those jurisdictions sets its own policy on conscientious objection. And miraculously, thanks be to God, we have, of the 10 provincial jurisdictions, eight have been reasonable. And in one case, I spent like 4 years dialoguing with a particular college to get provisions in that would accommodate us. But this college in Nova Scotia, ironically, it's a small province, 1 million people, but we have some of Canada's strongest proponents of euthanasia here. And they are so sure of the rightness of their cause that they are forcing this under the pain of loss of license. So we currently have a huge shortage here of physicians. There's 150,000 people in our province who do not have a doctor. And we've gone to government and said, we have at least 30 doctors who say they can't practice. But this gives you an idea, Peter. This is what I'm trying to get across to people. When it comes to these ideological folks, they are absolutely totalitarian in their beliefs and their approach. There's no subjectivity at all, and it's extremely ruthless. It's uncaring. You can see this in the way they respond to those two cases that I talked to you about. Any normal human would see the compassion for the father who's losing a daughter. Any normal human would see the awful situation that this poor man was put in. But the people who are proposing this have a very, because they do not have God in their life, they're extremely ideologically, secularly minded to the point of excluding any concept of God from healthcare. And that's really what we're up against here. It's a mammoth battle between good and evil.
Now there's a question here. So you've got a setup where the law on conscience can be different in different provinces, and that would inevitably raise questions about doctor migration. And Shirley Vandermeer, who is saying here, I know how severe the shortage of family physicians is right across Canada. I've already moved from British Columbia to Alberta, partly due to conscience right concerns. How likely would the doctors of Nova Scotia be if they threatened, if they were threatened with this, that there would be a flow of doctors out of the province of Nova Scotia to other places, leaving the province you say is already seriously underdoctored at the moment? Do you think we would see more of that if this kind of draconian law was passed?
Absolutely. What happens, Peter, as you know, is that doctors are, after 12 years, I know doctors are very different than lawyers. They don't like to fight, and so they will vote with their feet. They'll retire early, they'll move to another province. It's always enticing to go to the United States where you can earn more money. Or even perhaps to the UK when you can have the experience of monarchy in your hometown. And the other thing is too, is that our 30 doctors are treated with contempt by the regulator. Like he perceives these people to be nothing, not worthy of the practice of medicine. So, and the ironic thing is that these people, the 30, if you actually know who they are, and we can't go public with them because they're afraid of losing their license. But one of them is a palliative care doctor who just went to a hugely underserviced area of the province to run palliative care there. Three of them have been Nova Scotia Family Physician of the Year in different years. One is a psychiatrist in a very underserviced area. Two are involved in important roles in health administration in the province. Like these people are, they're like star candidates, and that's the dichotomy, the two worlds. I find it hard sometimes even to understand that this, as far as the regulator's concerned, they're hated because they're not helping patients, they're not caring for patients. And yet the example of these people is that they're all leaders in their profession and are self-sacrificing to care for patients at the level that they are.
Yeah, so it's bitterly ironic, isn't it, when one thinks about the Hippocratic Oath, I will give deadly medicine to no one nor suggest such counsel, and then nor in like manner will I give a woman a pessary to produce abortion. So the irony here is that doctors who are upholding traditional medical ethics and the Hippocratic Oath are actually being threatened with losing their jobs, whereas those who go along with willfully breaking it are being protected from prosecution.
It's a total reversal. And my own son graduated from Dalhousie Medical School a few years ago. The Hippocratic Oath that they used at their oath ceremony was something that he couldn't even read it, because it was a form of the Hippocratic Oath that was had ambiguous language around protecting human life.
Sure. Well, they might call it the Hippocratic Oath, I guess. So now you talked about I was want to pick up your comments on what you called the medicalization of life, and I know looking at what's been happening in other parts of the world, I think particularly of the state of Oregon in the U.S., where assisted suicide but not euthanasia is legal. And when we looked at the criteria, or they publish them every year, the reasons people are asking for it, it's not medical reasons, it's not the relief of pain, it's existential symptoms, so-called loss of autonomy, loss of enjoyment of life, loss of happiness, fear of being a burden upon relatives, and so on, loss of meaning and purpose. These are not medical symptoms, and yet, as you say, a medical solution is being applied to them.
We have a palliative care guru here in Winnipeg who has written a lot of books. His name is Dr. Harvey Chachanov, and Dr. Chachanov has written a book called Dignity Therapy. He's a psychiatrist, but he does a lot of palliative care. And Chachanov says that dignity is not an absolute value. The sense of personal dignity is a subjective sense, and the way society or the care team cares for the patient can enhance their sense of their own dignity, right? He's done studies on this, and Chachanov has about 26 factors that affect patient dignity. And he has counseling advice, counseling direction, and also palliative care interventions that can help with each of those symptoms of a loss of dignity. So this makes no sense, because these existential issues can be dealt with proper counseling and these palliative care interventions.
Yes, and you could argue that medical symptoms have medical treatments, of course. We relieve pain and nausea
Yes, of course.
obstruction and so on, but actually existential symptoms should have existential interventions,
Correct.
not medical interventions.
Correct. And I would even go further to say that, some of these existential problems are caused by a lack of faith in someone's life. So, as society rejects Christ and God in general, then there's more a greater likelihood for these symptoms, a loss of meaning, loss of a sense of dignity, like you say, all of these concerns. even fear of pain is an existential concern.
As opposed to real pain.
As opposed to real pain, because as Chachanov says, you need to have your palliative care doctor sit with you and look at all the various scenarios in the course of your illness and to say, look, if this happens, we can provide this treatment. If this happens, we can provide this treatment. And that helps settle the patient down. So my point is that if we take God out of the equation, then it's natural that people are going to be unsettled and have all these concerns when they face death. And then we give them death because we don't have any other solution for them. And then perhaps the doctors feel better in that they are able to resolve this. But the point is, they're not God. Doctors cannot resolve all problems. And by medicalizing this, it makes us responsible for the state of every patient, which is too high a responsibility. It's just impractical.
Yes, sure. So Trevor Stammers is saying just very distressing cases. I mean, the two you've described, and the second one, of course, the man with tetraplegia, the irony about this was that this man was neglected, maltreated, arguably abused, resulting in bed sores, which then led him to plead for euthanasia. So the doctors actually created the situation in the first place and then complied with his so-called wish. But Trevor Stammers is asking, with regard to the first case, surely all psychological illness could be said in some sense to be neurological disorders. Will this young woman's case open the floodgates to more psychiatrically unwell people getting euthanasia from the precedent set by this case? And you mentioned that the law on mental health is not due to change till 2027, but what is happening? Is there euthanasia for other mental health conditions taking place at the moment?
Well, this is the problem in a nutshell, is that it doesn't really matter what Parliament says, because you see, there's no oversight to the doctor looking at the criteria and saying, yes, this person is within these criteria. There's no oversight for that. So if they say, well, in my opinion, this person has a neurological disorder, it's not a mental health issue, then there's no appeal of that. So this is, when I heard this, I was totally shocked. Of course, I'm a layperson. I don't know the difference between a mental health concern and a neurological disorder. I thought that a mental health concern would include both neurological disorders and other types of disorders. To me, autism and ADHD is mental health for me. But it just shows you that the MAID practitioners themselves are setting their own ground rules. And there's nobody who is willing to police that.
Yeah, and you say there's no accountability. Mark Pickering, who's your equivalent, you know, Mark, well, he's your equivalent in CMF UK. And he's saying, Larry, can you share what arguments have been helpful in reaching better agreement with the regulatory bodies in the other provinces? You mentioned how the conscience laws are better in 8 out of 10. And is there any particular reason why Nova Scotia is proving so intransigent with this?
Well, I think that there's a difference between doctors, you know, who might be willing to permit MAID, and then the ideological people that are driven by ideology. As I said before, if the doctors could work these things out, there would be a resolution very quickly, because you guys are worst used to working in a collegial atmosphere where you try to, you know, accommodate colleagues in whatever way you can. The unfortunate thing is that the lawyers have got their hands in this, and the lawyers are setting down these rules. And then the doctors, rather than, you know, I wish the medical profession would say, butt out, it's not your business. So where we can get somebody who's pragmatically focused, if they're pragmatically focused, they say to themselves, I don't want to lose 30 doctors. And by the way, these are nice doctors. These are smart doctors. These are doctors that don't ordinarily give us any trouble. That's where it turns. Unfortunately, in Nova Scotia, we have like four of the top proponents in Canada are here in Nova Scotia. And they're absolutely ideologically focused. And they not only want effective referral in Nova Scotia, they want to force it in every other college. In their view, the other colleges are being overly cautious, overly fearful. There should be effective referral everywhere. So that's exactly what we're dealing with. I think to answer Mark's question, we don't use the word conscience anymore because it's not a good word. We don't use the word referral anymore because it's not a good word. If you try to use those two words in a public campaign, it won't work because the public doesn't understand referral. They don't understand the meaning of a referral from a doctor's perspective. What we're using that has been successful in this campaign is the college has proposed a policy, 30 doctors can't follow it. And the college has said they're going to take away their licenses. That is our lead headline, and that is the headline that works. And then let the college explain why a referral is essential. And then I go on the media and I go, well, we'll provide information. And the province, this is the thing, Peter. The province currently provides, if you don't have a doctor, you just call the province and they will set you up for an assessment for me. So if you don't have a doctor, you can get an assessment for me within 24 hours or 48 hours. If you have a doctor who's a conscientious objector, then that doctor must make a referral. That's the situation in Nova Scotia right now. And to the press, to the public, this doesn't make any sense at all. It's just crazy.
Well, sadly, we've run out of time. We've got more questions we could run on with, and this debate will run and run. But thank you, Dhairi, for so beautifully describing the horrendous situation in Canada, the lessons you've learned. Thank you so much for the example you've set in fighting this successfully in a number of provinces already, and you'll be very much in our prayers going forward as well. But I think everyone listening, I think the message coming from you is that we all need to take note, because if this has happened in a democratic country in Canada, an advanced technologically, supposedly a country based on Christian principles, then it could happen anywhere, really. And forearmed or forewarned is forearmed. And you guys are really the canaries in the coal mine saying, look, you've got to take this threat very seriously and mitigate against it. So we will continue to pray for you, but also to look to you and the experience you've gained in fighting these battles elsewhere. So it just remains to me again to say thanks again, Larry, for your time and your example, your courage under fire on this issue, and for your hard work, and to all of you for joining us here on ICMDA webinars. So thanks again. We look forward to seeing you again soon on ICMDA webinars. God bless you.